You're listening to Extinct, a podcast about dead things. I'm Alice Leggett. Together, we'll explore the stories of species that have existed over millions of years, from the earliest forms of life to those that died out more recently, as well as modern biodiversity loss and conservation initiatives. You're listening to Extinct. In this episode, we're exploring death and decay and focusing on the remains of a species of crocodile from the Cretaceous period, Isis fortia. This species of crocodile lived almost 100 million years ago in outback Queensland around Isisford, which is near the state's dinosaur hotspot, Winton. Isis fortia is the oldest crocodile known in Australia and could be a descendant of crocodiles found today. To tell us more, we have Queensland Museum Collection Manager in Geoscience, Dr. Caitlin Syme. Dr. Syme is a paleontologist who specialises in taphonomy, the process of decay and fossilisation. Dr. Syme has worked on a number of notable specimens over her career, including dinosaurs, crocodiles and fish. Dr. Syme focused on Isis fortia for her PhD at the University of Queensland, and her work was published in Royal Society Open Science in 2018. Caitlin, it's wonderful to have you on the show. My first question, many people possibly haven't heard of taphonomy before. How did you get into this and what drew your interest initially?
What really got me into taphonomy, which is trying to understand how animals died and decayed and were buried and eventually became fossils, is that the fossil that you're looking at can sometimes be distorted, there can be parts missing. It's not really showing you what that animal looked like in life. And I found it really intriguing, this idea of sort of reversing the clock and rebuilding that animal and trying to figure out what happened to it so I can undo that damage and see what the animal looked like when it was alive.
In terms of taphonomy being like a branch of paleontology, what sort of extra insights do you think that brings in the process of describing and looking at fossils?
It lets you know a lot about the environment that that animal was living in. So I like to think of these fossil animals, fossil plants, any fossil really, as a bit of a time capsule that's capturing information about the climate, the different other animals and plants and things that were living in that same space and interacting with that animal. So you might look at a fossil and see some bones missing and see little tooth scratch marks on the surface of other bones. And that could tell you that there are scavengers about in this ecosystem. Or you might find a fossil of a land-based animal out in an ocean deposit. And you know that it wasn't living in the ocean, so it must have been swept out to sea. And if it's a large animal, then what kind of storm events are we talking about that there must have been to wash such a large animal out into the middle of the ocean? So it provides a lot of information about environmental conditions. It provides information about ecology and how plants and animals interact with one another.
That situational information can tell you a lot, of course. But speaking of fossilization, can you tell us a little bit about the actual process and how fossilization works and what sort of conditions are advantageous for fossilization?
The best kind of conditions for a fossil to form would be in an aquatic setting, so either an ocean or a lake or a river. The best of those would be a lake, something that's pretty stagnant as well, that doesn't have a lot of creatures living in it that are trying to scavenge a carcass and gnaw away at soft tissue and impact on the bone. And then having a carcass getting buried relatively quickly. So if you have silt or mud or sand washing into that lake environment and covering up that body, then it's really protected. And over time, that will become a fossil. If there continues to be the right type of conditions, if more sediment gets buried on top, if that lake dried up and that became the ground surface and it started to get eroded and creatures were walking across the top of that carcass, then it wouldn't fossilize very well. But the key environmental things you want are an aquatic setting and sediment or dirt soil, that sort of thing, covering over the carcass and kind of protecting it. And that makes for a really lovely time capsule.
With these water environments and situations being better for fossilization, does that mean that in general, do we have better fossils or more fossils found around water?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And that can bias our understanding of the ancient world, actually, that we are only finding these things in these aquatic settings. Finding land-based animals in aquatic settings, obviously, you know that they weren't living in those aquatic settings, but it really does alter our perspective on what type of creatures and what type of plants were in an environment if you're only getting things preserved in aquatic settings. Now, I will say that you can get preservation of material in other types of scenarios, like in a desert. So if you have really hot, dry conditions and you can mummify remains and then have those buried in a sandstorm, then that can definitely give you a good fossil, but you won't get as much soft tissue. You won't get a lot of the plants and fungi and other sort of soft-bodied creatures, little invertebrates, little beetles and things like that wouldn't be as well preserved in that kind of environment. So it does sort of alter our understanding. We know that there are these gaps in the fossil record and we have to try to figure out what information are we missing as well as what information do we have.
So it's almost like a confirmation bias looking around these particular environments and going, oh, there's heaps of stuff here but not in other places. So I can see why that would lead to people thinking that there might not have been as much stuff in these different environments.
Yeah, there could be and probably was a whole beautiful ecosystem of mountainous dinosaurs roaming around very hilly sort of environments, but if they're dying and their remains are being washed down streams, down rivers and away from those kind of settings, then we're not going to know that that's where they're actually living.
Now, the main fossil that we're here to chat about, so Australia is famous for its crocodiles. It's one of our most iconic animals when people think of Australia. And crocodiles are, of course, one of the oldest continuing types of animals on this planet. But the one we're here to talk about today, Isis Fortia, what's special about it?
Isis Fortia, at the time that it was discovered, and pretty much still now, is the oldest crocodilomorph. So that's from the crocodilian type group. But it's the oldest type of, let's just say, croc found in Australia. So it's about 101 million years old. And we've found fossils of crocs from younger geological formations that are about 40 million or 50 million years old. But being 101 million years, that changed our concept of when did crocodiles actually arrive in Australia. And it's also a very interesting animal because it can tell us a little bit about the evolutionary history of the modern crocodiles that we have, so saltwater crocodiles or estuarine crocodiles, as well as freshwater crocodiles. Where did their lineage begin? Are they from Southeast Asia? Are they from mainland Asia? Are they from South America? Or did they come from Isis Fortia?
And with Isis Fortia, can you tell us a bit about its characteristics and how it compares to current crocodiles that we see?
Yeah, so Isis Fortia is actually quite a wee little crocodile. So it was only about a metre and a half long at as adult size. And it looked a lot like a modern crocodile does. If you imagine a saltwater crocodile, it's got a scaly skin. It has osteoderms, which means bone in skin. So it has its bony armour in its skin. It's got a long snout. And it also has in its mouth a secondary palate, which helps it breathe with its mouth open underwater, waiting for food to come past. But it can have its nostrils at the surface of the water and be breathing that air in and not be choking at the same time because it's got its mouth open and full of water. So that makes it very similar to modern crocodiles. It was just much, much smaller.
Like a miniature version. Now, thinking of the fact that it hasn't really changed much, why do you think it potentially is that crocodiles have been pretty consistent over such a long stretch of time?
I think a lot of it has to do with if you have a niche in an ecosystem that you've filled, so you have found a particular environment that you're well suited for, well adapted for, and there's a good continual food source and the climate's right. So in the case of crocodilians, that it's warm, that you have access to water, so you're in the water a lot of the time and that's where you're hunting from and doing ambush predation from. But because you lay eggs, you still need to have land nearby to be able to hop up onto shore and make a nest and lay your eggs. So if those kind of environmental conditions persist, and if there aren't other types of animals that try to push you out of that niche, then realistically, if you've found the best body plan, as it were, to be quite long, to have a large, tall tail that acts like a paddle when they're swimming through water, to have these big jaws, big teeth, to grab prey, to pull it underwater and to drown their prey, then there's really no need to adapt to anything different. And so all these different types of crocs, if they're living in those same kind of environments, they have the same behaviours, then they're going to look pretty similar.
Fair enough. If you've got the formula down pat, why change it?
Yeah.
With the specimens that you have worked with for Isis fortia, what sort of state were they in?
The main specimen that I worked on, which is Isis fortia duncani, it's actually really beautifully articulated and very nearly complete. There's only a couple little bits missing. And that was a beautiful test bed for looking at the taphonomy of the fossil, looking at what's present, what's absent, how are the bones laying in relation to one another? Have they shifted at all from their life position? Is there any sign of anything gnawing on the bones? The original fossil, when it was found in the field, it was encased in a concretion, so this round boulder-type rock, and it had to get prepared over months, if not years, and this was before I joined this research team. So I was very fortunate that I got to work on a beautifully prepared fossil that was all ready to go, but it took quite a long time to get the layers of rock off of the fossil to see where all the bones were laid out. But once that happened, you could see this beautiful skeleton with nearly all of the bones in their life position. So legs and heads and that hadn't dropped off and been washed away. It was almost like looking at a perfect skeleton of the animal while it was alive. There were a few things that had moved about, but it's pretty much a perfect skeleton.
That sounds like a blessing, considering that so many fossils that are found are just in small pieces or just quite random almost in a sense. So that sounds like a really rare find.
It is. And a lot of the time, especially in Australia, we're dealing with very poorly preserved, eroded types of fossils. And you might have a leg bone here and an arm bone there. And you try to make your best interpretation of what animal you're looking at from those fossils. But when you find something like this that's just so beautifully preserved, it is amazing.
And I can imagine significantly easier to analyze if you've just got it right there, and it kind of takes the guesswork out of it a bit.
Absolutely.
Speaking of analyzing this, what sort of determinations did you learn from this analysis, and how best did you go about it as well?
So what I did is I mapped out all of the parts of the skeleton that I could see in this fossil and had a look at how they joined to one another. So was the shoulder still in its life position near the shoulder blade? Was the elbow still where you would expect it to be? Had any arms twisted around in a way that you'd think, oh, that must have been dislocated? There were a couple of leg bones on the right back leg that had definitely moved apart from one another in a way that if you were alive, it would not be good. You would have had a massive injury. So for that, I could tell there's definitely soft tissue trauma for those bones to move apart. But for them to have not completely separated from the skeleton and been washed away, the soft tissue was probably still sort of holding it together, like loose skin, loose muscle, while this animal was decaying. And really, the beautiful state of preservation of this fossil told me that it's been buried relatively quickly. So when I was talking before about things being buried in aquatic environments and lakes and rivers, that sort of thing, and then being buried by mud or silt or sand, that has to come from somewhere, whether it's, you know, maybe a storm event, or it might just be the natural flow of the river carrying a lot of mud and muck with it, and that sort of drops down gently and covers that body. The flow of the water could move bones about. So the lightest, smallest bones might completely disappear. Bigger, heavier bones might stay in place. With this particular specimen, things had sort of separated from one another in parts of the body, like that back leg, but they hadn't been washed away. So that told me that the speed of the water carrying sediment and laying the sediment on top of this fossil must have been quite a calm river type of environment.
Do you think more specimens of this species are likely to be found?
I think so. We have been out to the site where this fossil was found. We found other fossils there as well. So there are a couple of other bits of Isisfordia that have been located. Nothing as beautifully preserved as that. But I think the more you go out to those dig sites, the more erosion happens and reveals more of these concretion around boulder type rocks. Yeah, I think they're definitely there. It was the right type of environment to preserve these animals so, so beautifully. There's got to be more out there.
Yeah, totally. They just need to get a shovel and hopefully, you know, dig something up.
Yeah. It actually normally involves a lot of walking around with your head down, just looking, because there might not be really obvious boulders sitting on the surface of the soil. It might be a bit of rock poking out from behind a bit of bush or whatever, and there's a little bit of bone, and then that's when you start digging better. Yeah, it can take quite a lot of just roaming about looking to find anything.
Yeah, quite a bit of patience there, but it certainly pays off.
Mm.
What do you think life would have been like for Isisfordia all those years ago?
I think it would have actually been quite beautiful, because Isisfordia would have been living on the edge of this giant inland sea called the Eremanga Sea. And it was in a nice sort of warm environment. Because it's a crocodilian, we assume that to be happy and healthy and comfortable, it would be a slightly humid kind of warm environment like crocodiles like today. Otherwise, they would have just chosen to live somewhere else. And the types of plant fossils that you find in similar geological formations around there show that there would be ferns, there would be conifers, there would be horsetails. So it would be quite lush, beautiful coastal lush environment. And although this is a little croc and it might have been competing with large dinosaurs, large meat-eating dinosaurs for food, I think because it's found its little niche, because we know that crocs and the body plan of a crocodile has persisted over time for so long, I think it would have been quite a comfortable life for Isisfordia.
That sounds really peaceful, and you're almost describing like the perfect holiday.
That's why I think current day Isisfed was a coastal location about 101 million years ago. So yeah, it would have been a coastal seaside town.
Put that on the travel agent website, just that description, and wonderful, a great summer holiday. But with Isisfordia, what more do you think is still left to learn about them?
I think one of the things that's interesting that we need to learn more about Isisfordia is its evolutionary history, because when it was first found, we thought that it was the very beginning of modern crocodiles, because it has these particular characteristics that modern estuarine crocodiles have, one of them being a secondary palate so that they can have a valve at the back of the throat and breathe while they're sitting with their mouth open underwater and their nostrils at the surface. But over the years, as other people have found different types of crocodiles in South America, for example, they've found similar types of features in these crocodiles, and they're not linked to that same group of modern day saltwater crocodiles. So there are different features popping up in different croc groups, and they're not related to one another. So they are all still crocodilomorphs or crocodiliforms. This is like a large group of crocodile-shaped creatures, but they're all a little bit different evolutionarily. They're different parts of the family tree. And they've got very similar features. The features that you see in a modern-day crocodile, that's what you're seeing in these fossil crocodiles. But a lot of those parts of the family tree are a dead end. So it's more that good body shape for being in the water, having the nice tall paddle-like tail for swimming in the water, the secondary palate so that you can breathe while you still got your mouth open. That's just a very good way to inhabit that niche. And so those features are popping up in these different croc groups, even though they're not related to one another. And it seems that Isisfordia is not actually related to the modern-day saltwater crocodile, but maybe it is. The ideas keep changing. They're fluid. It totally depends on what new fossils you find, and is there any better preservation of those fossils that show you new features in the skeleton? Can you find older croc fossils in Australia? That would really help our understanding of how Isisfordia evolved. And with younger croc groups, whether Isisfordia was a dead end in the family tree or it did evolve into other forms of crocs too.
Hopefully we do uncover more of Isisfordia so we can figure this out, because it sounds like it's a fascinating species and there's only answers to learn.
And of course, I always want to look at the taphonomies, almost like a crime scene type of scenario is the way I like to think about taphonomy. So any new fossil site is exciting for me because, of course, the creatures themselves and what species and genera they are and the evolutionary history is super important. But I'm more interested in how do these animals relate to one another as far as how did they interact with one another? Did one of them hunt the other one? Did they live peacefully side by side because they were eating different types of foods? Were there plants or fungi that were growing through these skeletons of animals that had died that really impacted on how they were preserved? So that's the sort of thing I'm excited for, more Isisfordia, more crocodiles and older crocodiles, just to look at what environments were they living in.
Yeah, absolutely. And Caitlin, if anyone does happen to stumble across fossils or Isisfordia specifically out and about, what should they do with them? Who do they call?
So if you ever find a fossil out, whether it's on your own property, whether it's on the side of the road in a national park, you can always call your local museum and they will know exactly who to talk to and whether you should bring that fossil in or whether you should leave it in place. So taking a photo of any fossil you find and sending that to your local museum is going to be really useful, because that fossil, the way it is situated in the ground, might tell a really important story about what's nearby, what way is it facing up, facing down. So it's best to leave them where they are, take photos, send information to the museums, and they will let you know what to do next.
Fabulous. Keep your eyes peeled and talk to the museum if you find one. Caitlin, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us and telling us all about your work and Isisfordia.
Oh, no worries. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Extinct. I'm Alice Leggett. If you want to hear more about dead things, be sure to subscribe to the podcast. And don't forget to leave a rating or review. It helps Extinct reach more people who are passionate about the planet's past and future. Until next time, stay curious.